meeting of House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:18 on Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. And we're here in room 120. Please remember to mute cell phones today. Members present include Representative St. Clair, Representative McCabe, Representative Vance, Representative Holland, Representative Himshute, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary is Cecilia Miller. And our moderator from the Juno LIO is Renzo Moises. Our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay. Thank you all for helping today. We have four items on today's agenda. We'll start with an additional hearing on House Bill 130 on flexible time credit from Representative Josephson, including discussion of amendments. We then have continued discussion on House Bill 250 from Representative Hannon, followed by taking up and looking to the will of the committee on HCR 10 and HB 290 from Representative Holland. Before we get started today, I do have one housekeeping item. I am extending the amendment deadline for House Bill 152, the education head tax from Representative Galvin, from Friday, March 6th at 5 p.m. to Monday, March 9th at noon. This is to give their office more time to get back to the committee's questions that were asked at a previous hearing and to allow Ledge Legal more time to potentially prepare amendments on that bill. So Monday, March 9th at noon is the new amendment deadline. Please get amendments to my office by that time. The first item on our agenda today is House Bill 130 on flexible time credit from Representative Josephson. This is our third hearing on the bill. At our last hearing, we set an amendment deadline for Monday, March 2nd at 5 p.m. and received several amendments. I would like to welcome Representative Josephson, who is here, and his staff, Ken Alper, to start us off with any opening remarks you have before we jump into the amendment process.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andy Josephson, House District 13, with Mr. Ken Alper. I've reviewed the amendments. I find the first two helpful in framing the bill itself, and I find the third one pretty strongly objectionable in that it would position people in the cohort, like Mr. Minnick, who testified, in a worse position in two ways. In fact, if it's read super narrowly, one could argue that it's that without pre-approval, the benefit for flex time wouldn't come at all, potentially. Unfortunately, I have to go... chair a couple subcommittee meetings immediately, but I would deputize Mr. Alper to take care of and cover my position moving forward.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Josephson. You. Appreciate the introductory remarks. And we will go through the amendments one by one, though. So if Mr. Alper, you could stay at the table, we can look to you for the sponsor's comments on the amendments. So at this time, we'll begin our amendment process on House Bill 130. And before us, first, I have Amendment 1, also known as N.1, Representative St. Clair.
I move Amendment 1.
And I'll object for discussion.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, the intent of this amendment is just to power it down to the lowest level. Let the supervisor, who has the best contact with the employee, knows the workload, power it down to them to approve or deny requests for flexible time credits. All it does is, like I said, if they're coming into a busy time when they've got deadlines, they can deny it at that lowest level. Or if they're quiet, nothing really going on, they can approve it at that lowest level.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. And before we entertain additional discussion, I'll look to Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ken Alper, staff to Representative Josephson. And And you might recall, Madam Chair, that Representative St. Clair asked a question on the record while we were discussing the bill, that this would this be subject to supervisor approval? And I said yes. And I view this amendment, Representative Josephson views this amendment as clarifying what already exists. He doesn't have any specific issues with it. I went once the amendments arose and looked at the contracts of the two main unions, the General Government Union and the Supervisors Union, and they both have specific provisions in their flexible time sections that say the use of it is subject to supervisor approval, so that, you know, we're not harming anything. We're clarifying and making it part of the legal record. So Representative Josephson is fine with the amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Alpert. Do we have questions on this amendment? Seeing none around the table, I'm going to remove my objection. And seeing and hearing no further objection, amendment number 1, also known as N.1, has been adopted. That brings us to amendment number 2, also known as N.2, Representative Holland.
Hi, thank you. I move amendment number 2.
And I'll object for discussion, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Amendment number 2 addresses a concern that we both understand, that there needs to be some potential limits and controls on the amount of comp time, but also that it's important to preserve the union's ability to collectively bargain and negotiate for these agreements. So the amendment is seeking to provide that flexibility of both identifying that the amount of flexible time that they may accrue has some sort of cap or control on it. The current bill doesn't speak to potentially being an unlimited amount. In researching this, I learned that the collective bargaining agreements generally do have caps and rules on how to use the comp time. So this was meant to be consistent and complementary of those existing processes while still including the notion that there would be a cap on that, and that that cap would be guided by the question of ensuring that the state services are being provided for, and that the ability to identify when there's a need for hiring additional staff would be clear in the future. So I appreciate the opportunity to present this.
Thank you, Representative Holland. Again, I'll look to Mr. Alper for comments from the sponsor's office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Josephson, likewise with the previous amendment, views this as fundamentally clarifying. I went to the union contracts, the current ones, both of them have caps on them. Representative Holland is correct. In fact, both of them have the same cap. It's a 200-hour limitation on how much an employee can accrue at any one time. And per the previous amendment, subject to the approval of their supervisor to be able to use it. So Representative Josephson does not have any concern with adopting this amendment.
Is there additional committee discussion on amendment number 2? Seeing none around the table, I'm going to remove my objection. And seeing no additional objection, amendment number 2, also known as N.2, has been adopted. And that will bring us to amendment number 3. I'll turn to Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number 3.
I'll object for discussion. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. HB 130 creates a new statutory framework for flexible time credit for classified employees who are not eligible for overtime. I understand the intent of the bill. It's designed to recognize additional work performed by salaried employees. However, when we create a new form of paid time off in statute, especially one tied to hours worked beyond a standard and normal salaried work week, we need clear structure, limits, and accountability. That's what this amendment provides. First, the amendment clarifies that flex time credit accrues only after 45 hours worked in a week. That ensures we are recognizing truly excessive hours, not minor scheduling variations or routine workload fluctuations, which is sort of the reason to have salaried employees in the first place. If we are going to create this benefit, it should apply to meaningful additional work over and above that normally expected of a salaried employee. Let me expand on this a little bit. When you hire a salaried employee, you do so specifically so that he will be able to cover across shifts. He will be able to stay when the hourly workers are off at 5 and the next shift comes in at 5:30 or 6. The salary guy, the supervisor, stays a little bit extra so he can brief him. That's what a salaried worker is for. Second, the amendment requires pre-approval and documentation before flex time credit can accrue. This is basic management practice. Time off with pay should not accumulate automatically without supervisor oversight. This protects the collective bargaining agreement, it protects the employee, and it protects the agency. Third, the amendment places a reasonable cap, 120 hours per fiscal year, and limits carryover. Without this cap, this could quietly grow into a significant operational and fiscal liability. I've seen this happen before with an employee accruing enough time off benefit to take months off at the end of his employment. I've even seen guys use this time, 6-8 months worth of accrued time, to get another job while they were still employed by the agency that they were getting the flex time credit for. We shouldn't create unlimited accruals in a state facing structural deficits. And I understand that the collective bargaining's agreements have a cap, many of them do, but that might not always be the case depending on the negotiation. These agreements are negotiated every 3 to 5 years. And I think if we're going to work in the arena of collective bargaining agreements, sorry, I had some ice in my cup and it's if we're going to work in that, then we need to make sure that we put the collars and controls on it that we need to. Fourth, it ensures division directors retain discretion over when flex time may or must be used. Agencies must be able to deny leave during peak operational periods or when absence would impair services. Government must remain functional first and foremost. That's our job. Finally, the amendment requires the Department of Administration to track usage and report annually to the legislature on fiscal and operational impacts. If we create a new benefit, it should measure its cost. We should be able to measure its costs and effects. Transparency and oversight are not controversial. They are responsible governance. This amendment does not eliminate flex time credit. It simply adds guardrails. It ensures management authority remains intact. It ensures operational continuity and ensures the legislature receives the data on how this program functions in practice. If we're going to put this in statute, we should do it carefully and responsibly. And I would respectfully ask for the committee's support of Amendment 3.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. And I'll turn again to Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as Representative Josephson, before he had to leave, put out, he is generally opposed to Representative McCabe's Amendment Number 3. To put a little color to that, there's really two different tracks of concern. One is on the management side, a lot of the protections sought by this amendment are already in the contract. A flexible time plan needs to be agreed to in advance by the employee, the supervisor, and the director. That's a process that every agency sets up. Likewise, the use of the flex time requires supervisor approval per the contract and now per previously adopted Amendment 1. But really, the broader, larger concern with Amendment 3 is that it in many ways weakens the contracts as they currently exist. The intent of the bill when Representative Josephson introduced it was to put, and I think I used the words in my earlier testimony, a floor, sort of a minimum standard for future contracts as to what the administration, the state would be expected to give in their workings with public employees. And this bill sort of flips that upside down and establishes a ceiling that in many ways is more onerous on the employer, more restrictive than the current employee contracts. Just to spell out a couple of examples, as written, this amendment would say you only could accrue comp time for hours worked above 40, whereas in the supervisors union, you don't accrue any until you get above 45 hours. In the supervisors union contract, you don't accrue any time until you get to the 45 hours, but then you earn the 5 hours back to the 40th hour work, which is your contractual amount that's in your contract. So they would be losing those 5 hours per week if they're working a lot of comp time. Likewise, the current contracts, both GGU and SU, have a 200-hour cap. This establishes a 120-hour cap, which is less than that. It also says, and this is subtle, but it's concerning, hours can't be carried over into the next fiscal year. And there's a legitimate concern that as you get to May, June, employees would be looking to try to use up their hours so as to not lose them, creating more operational issues in the springtime. You know, I think about agencies with a lot of summer work, transportation, fish and game, so on. It's really hard to let people go in the lead up to the summer season. We're also requiring approval of the director level person to use the time. That seems a little high up the food chain. A lot of directors of the larger agencies don't even know all of their employees personally. This seems more appropriately in the purview of the direct supervisor. So all in all, just because we are now the way the bill is written, the applicability section, Madam Chair, says that the changes in the bill take effect on the contract signed after the effective date of the bill. So the current contracts would remain the rule, but then the expectation, should Amendment 3 pass, would be the next generation of public employee contracts would have to be weaker on the employee's behalf and more strict in the use of comp time. And for all of those reasons, Representative Josephson would hope the committee would fail to adopt this particular amendment. Thank you.
I'm gonna allow for discussion on it. I did have a quick question, Mr. Alpert. Under this legislation, can employees accrue flex time credit and then cash it out just at the end of their service, like you could with leave currently?
No, Madam Chair. The comp time, flex time does not have a cash value. There is no ability to do that. In fact, generally speaking, if you change jobs, if you move to a different position, you can't take your flex time with you. It's much more restrictive in that way versus traditional leave.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I'm going to come back to Representative McCabe and see if there's questions from other committee members. Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't see this amendment is unreasonable, especially when it comes to end of year, the flex time resets. And like you said, like Mr. Alper said, it's non-monetary. I think managers in the military, we had to do this. At the end of the year, you had use or lose, and we had to program that out throughout the year. If you're really busy in the summer, then they need to take their comp time or flex time in the wintertime. I see this is a management issue and not necessarily a legislative issue.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. I don't think I have as much of a question as an observation, which is that as I started working on this bill, I essentially wrote an amendment very similar to this one. I have a lot of respect for the representative's perspective on managing employees and writing handbooks and providing some structure, particularly as we, you know, cross between those two worlds of the exempt and the non-exempt employee and what that means and the benefits and the obligations that go with it. That being said, you know, after working on this more and looking at the collective bargaining agreements, I essentially dialed it back down to this amendment that we just looked at a moment ago, which essentially, you know, establishes that there needs to be a cap on there, but leaves it up to the units, the collective bargaining organizations, to figure out the details. Because I really came to the conclusion that while if I were writing the handbook and running a business unit and had a handbook for employees, I'd have a lot of what I see here. I think this is prudent, makes a lot of sense to me. But, you know, at the point of us creating statute and kind of that higher level guidance, I felt like it was getting into more detail that would be precluding an awareness of a particular situation in an agency or department, what they needed to do and what they collectively agreed was prudent to provide the working environment they needed to. So I moved away from getting in this level of specificity. I have a lot of respect for the perspective that this is built on, and I'm sure this would be very appropriate perhaps in some areas, but I decided that I couldn't support getting into this level of detail as much as I was drawn to do the same thing. I'm also concerned the reporting requirement that this introduces to me would be very onerous. I think the thing about flex time is that it's supposed to be kind of informal and flexible and hopefully used as a bare minimum in order to get things done and be respectful of people's time. But trying to do the reporting and then trying to both log the time, track the time, and then do the report to us, I felt like was adding a level of administrative work and a fiscal cost to this that I didn't think was necessary. So I won't support the amendment, but I do support the intent and the perspective and experience that is behind some of the ideas in here.
Okay, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So a couple things. When you go to a supervisory position, you're actually expected to work more. That's why a supervisory position pays more. You are expected to be able to do those. If I went from a line pilot to a chief pilot, I hear that complaint all the time from the chief pilots. Hey, you know, I could make more money picking up open time trips and being a regular line pilot than I am as a chief pilot. But then again, I'm a chief pilot and you're not, so I'm going to take your trip, Captain McCabe. point being is a supervisor has a different level of abuse that they are expected to receive, if you will. Abuse is the wrong word, but you know what I mean, from management, frankly. And as far as a report from a director level, if a director doesn't know who his supervisors are, I think the whole state is in trouble. This shouldn't matter how many employees are in the unit. He should know who his supervisors are. As far as carrying carrying it into the next year, you don't carry vacation into the next year. I could never carry over vacation. I had to take my vacation by the end of the year or I lost it. So this is no different than that. And I can see, if we carried over 200 hours a year for 3, 5, 6, and that's what the contracts say, 6 years plus vacation, you could have an entire year off. Now, how's a manager of a bargaining unit or manager of a department supposed to plan for that? I didn't spend the level of time in the contracts that you obviously did, Representative Holland, but I also know that contracts can be rewritten pretty easily and pretty quickly. And in fact, if the contracts were actually written right, the salaried employee would be making enough money that we wouldn't be talking about this right now, frankly. And so to me, the negotiators, the union negotiators, failed when they wrote that contract that put the gentleman that testified in that position where he is actually making less money. I am very concerned, and you heard me say it before. Number one, I think it should be up to the supervisor to handle this without us putting it in statute. And I don't think we should be dabbling in contract negotiation in the legislature. That is not our job. I mean, frankly, we don't get paid enough to do it. As a contract negotiator, you can get paid a pile more to do it than as a legislator. So anyways, that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Is there additional committee discussion on amendment number 3? Seeing none, do appreciate the discussion. I think fundamentally, I am opposed to this amendment. I think Mr. Alpert described it the way I look at it, in setting a ceiling rather than a floor. And I kind of appreciate the way the bill is currently written in that regard. And I also, while I, in a lot of cases, do like for there to be some kind of reporting requirement, I don't really like it in this amendment. So for those reasons, I'm going to retain my opposition. Representative McCabe.
So if you don't mind, let me give you an example of why we set a ceiling in some of these cases. So United, a number of years ago when they were negotiating their contract, they realized that at some point, if the pilots flew enough open time in a month, eventually, because of FAA regulations, they could have the last 3 months of the year off because the FAA limits you by yearly time. So they found that they had to set a cap on how much overtime you could fly. Sometimes a cap is necessary. It makes good management sense. It gives the manager and the director control over his department. And so while I agree with you that, that this does maybe set a cap, there's reasons for that.
That generated a little more discussion. We'll go to Representative Himshute and then back to Mr. Alper.
Just on a related topic, I'm confirming you would support a cap for corrections officers too then.
I was happy.
Okay. Mr. Alper, did you have additional comment?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify one thing. Looking at the contract, and I think it might benefit the committee. I'll give to your aide after the hearing the appropriate pages from the two main public employee contracts. I think they should be in the record and track this bill, presuming it moves on to another committee. But both of the contracts clearly say the 200-hour limit is not per year. It's an aggregate number. An employee can't hold more than 200 hours at any given point. They can't continue to accrue them if they get beyond that number. It's not like after 3 years you could have 600 hours of flex time.
Okay. We're going to try to sort of wrap up discussion on this amendment. So we'll go to Representative St. Clair and then McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make it quick. The comparison between DOC and others is apples and oranges. DOC has to remain open and operational for 24 hours a day for public safety. And based on these other supervisory positions, I think it's a non-starter. It's apples and oranges.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. Representative McCabe.
So again, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Alper, contracts can be rewritten very easily. And were we to establish something in here that they could easily take out of there in the next contract negotiation as a negotiator, it'd be gone. So I'm sorry, but if we are going to dabble in this arena, we need to make sure we do it right. And leaving it open for another contract, a sharp contract negotiator, would be an issue for me.
Thank you. The objection is maintained, and I will ask the clerk to please call the roll at this time on amendment number 3.
Representative Himshute.
No.
Representative Holland.
No.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative St. Clair.
Yes.
Representative Story.
No.
Chair Carrick.
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
With a vote of 3 yeas and 4 nays, Amendment Number 3, also known as N.3, is not adopted. And that is the last amendment that we have on House Bill 130. Is there further discussion on House Bill 130 at this time? Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to see the documents that Mr. Alper has offered to see us before we do too much more with this legislation.
Okay. So we are going to take action on this bill today, but I would ask Mr. Alper, please send us those documents you referred to, and I'd like to upload them to the committee record as well as for the bill. I do think that's a valuable component of this discussion, and that request is noted. Seeing no further discussion at this time on House Bill 130, I would look to a motion from Representatives or Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move House Bill 130, also known as 34-LS0582/N, as amended from the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Objection.
And there is an objection. Would you like to speak to your objection? I don't see any additional discussion, and I'm assuming the objection is maintained. So I'll have the clerk please call the roll on House Bill 130.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Humeshoot.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative St. Clair.
No.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 130 has moved from the House State Affairs Committee. We will now take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. At ease.
Thank you, Madam.
Affairs is back on the record, and the next item on our agenda today is House Bill 250 for peace officer face masks from Representative Hannon. This is our third hearing on the bill. Today we are going to continue discussion on the bill, and the intention is to set an amendment deadline. I also want to note that we do have a couple other agenda items today, so our discussion on this bill will be limited to about 4:30 p.m., and then I would ask that members after that connect with the sponsor or my office if there's additional questions that need to be answered. I'd like to also note that we have folks from the Alaska Police Standards Council here today, and I'd like to welcome Sarah Heeb with the Alaska Police Standards Council, who's in the room with us. Thank you for being here. We also, just for committee members' information, did invite Chief Case again to join us, and I don't believe he's available today, but he was invited to be here with us. At this time, I'd like to welcome Representative Hannon and her staff, Tim Clark, back before us. And is there additional discussion on House Bill 250 today? I was looking at Representative St. Clair because I knew there was going to be discussion. Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just keep it brief. The Anchorage Police Chief has clearly said that he opposes this legislation. California legislation has been used as an example, but from what I've been able to find, it was only excluded local and federal agencies. And it's been noted in several articles that I found, which I can reproduce for the committee if necessary. It even says the Los Angeles Police Department is not even enforcing that rule because they understand that anonymity is important. They have their badges out. They have their identifying agencies out. They have, I think they're required to have their badges and their agency they're with out, so you can obtain their badge number. You can get their information. If you ask an officer, what's your badge number, they're supposed to give it to you. So I think we're addressing something that should be addressed at potentially the federal level, but I oppose any restrictions like this on any type of law enforcement.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. I'll just help kickstart the discussion today, too, by saying that I have some hesitations about putting this into statute as well, but I also think about the status quo. Even just 5-10 years ago, body cams were not the standard, and they were often opposed by law enforcement agencies. And now, if you talk to many law enforcement agencies, they're very supported because they help protect both the officer and the public in those situations. From a misinterpretation on the situation, they help insulate in legal cases and disputes. And so I do think that's one example, and this may be another example where we actually move the needle in a positive direction for the public and for law enforcement. So I just kickstart the discussion there as well. Representative McCabe.
So thank you, Chair Carrick. It's interesting to me to juxtapose the hearing we had yesterday, where we are concerned with the rights of privacy of Alaskans and against this, where we are not concerned with the rights of privacy of a law enforcement official who is doing a job that he's been directed to do by a government official, which we sort of fit that bill, not that we could direct law enforcement. You also mentioned cameras. It's interesting to me that we at times have wanted body cameras. At times we have not wanted red light cameras because of the same privacy issues, right? So it is a kind of a weaving path that we go down. And I am just concerned for the safety of our law enforcement officials and their families. There's no other reason to oppose this other than that if they felt, or if their bosses feel strong enough that there is an issue, especially with the new proliferation of social media, all the deep fakes that we see out there that we discussed on the floor last week, where you could actually make a video based on an officer's voice and his likeness. You could make a video of him saying or doing anything. We have a senator in the other body that had an audio of her voice made and played to her mother saying that she had been in an accident and could she please get $8,000 wired, and she did. So those kinds of things, I think, are what officers, supervisors, and the officers themselves are trying to protect themselves from. And I think that we need to, these guys have a hard job. Yes, they signed up for it. They knew that what they were getting into, but I don't think they signed up to have people go to their homes, to have people dox them, to have people threaten their families, and any of the other number of things that we've seen. And it's social media. I mean, if it was just the print media out there taking flash pictures of 20 or 30 years ago, it wouldn't be a big deal. It's a big deal now. You can lift an officer's likeness directly off the internet based on the hundreds of cell phone cameras that are around and get a pretty good likeness of him in a film doing something. And I think we make a mistake if we don't, at least for now, protect those officers.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. I wanted, before we go for second bites at the apple, I'd like to just offer an opportunity for the bill sponsor to comment if she would like.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sarah Hannon, House District 4. I'm not sure if you want me to engage in debate amongst your committee members or just some observations that I could share that the opposition expressed both from the Chief of Police in Anchorage, and I believe you've received two letters of opposition from police unions. In none of those has the opposition expressed concerns about doxing of officers or their family. They've all asserted this is not a practice we have in Alaska, therefore we don't need this. And I'll return to some of my comments at the original bill hearing, which is that's exactly why this bill has been introduced. This is not a practice of law enforcement for most law enforcement agencies in Alaska. But frequently we see federal positions on things spread to states, and if a state already has a standard in place, then usually that is a good defense against the feds do not need to step in with a standard for teaching, nursing, policing, because your state already regulates this. And what I want to assure and affirm is the standards that Alaskan police departments largely subscribe to now, and in every time I've ever heard a public safety agency in Alaska describe their police work, they talk primarily about their work with their community, the need for de-escalation, the trust that they build, whether they're the Alaska State Trooper responding in a search and rescue, or where they're a community police officer encountering someone having a mental health crisis. They talk to the fact that they need to build that rapport and de-escalate a situation. I think if a standard of policing that involves masked presence, unless it is needed for specific reasons, that we introduce an escalation of a conflict that doesn't need to be there. And so along the way, I know that many police officers, you're expressing that they feel like this is in opposition to them, and I'm going to continue to assert, I believe this affirms the standards that they've trained to in Alaska and they currently operate under, and that's why I think we need a bill to do that, to make sure that those Alaskan standards of community policing continue.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. And we'll continue the discussion. Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to not try and take up too much time. I know we want to get this moved on. And it's obvious that I oppose this legislation. I've asked the question, how many times have officers been seen masked in the format or the way that's being described in here? No one can tell me. And if you look back at videos for the Occupy Anchorage, the Occupy movement, and even the Black Lives Matter, you will notice the police are not masked. Who are masked are the protesters. And that may be an amendment that I may bring up on this, because if we want fair and equitable, then it needs to be across the board. And this is not a problem in Alaska that I've been told of, that the police chiefs and the law enforcement are telling you, no, we don't do this. It's not needed. And I support them. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hannon, respectfully, what you're saying is that you want to establish clear standards. But my question to you is why you didn't put this in the police standards. What you've given and handed us is a crime bill. And this is in the section of law that is misconduct of a public official. And you're instead of establishing a standard for peace officers, you're making it a crime. What you've told us as the justification is very different than what the bill is actually doing. And I'd like to hear your position on why you took that approach.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Vance, the Alaska Police Standards Council does not regulate all the law enforcement in Alaska, only licensed in local police departments. And so we want to make sure that whether it's a federal law enforcement officer or a VPSO or a tribal police, they are all meeting this under the statute. And the Police Standards Council does not set standards that apply to all levels of law enforcement in Alaska.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, I might as well rip the Band-Aid off here. What we're talking about is Minneapolis, and I get that. It's emotional. A couple of citizens were killed. But if the Minneapolis police, and this is a bit of an editorializing, had done what you say and what Chief Case says and what we all know our police departments would do and be there to protect the ICE officers themselves, likely that wouldn't have happened. So I 100% agree with Representative Hannon that our community policing and the way Chief Case does it and the way I know our troopers do it is 100% the way to go. Fact of the matter is we shouldn't need this legislation if a federal ICE officer came into Alaska, came into Anchorage somewhere, and the Anchorage police would be there to support them because they are the community people. They're the ones that know the people that come out on the streets, and they could say, hey, wait a minute, let's let them do their job. They could do what they're trained to do with their community. Unfortunately, in Minneapolis, that didn't happen, and we are reacting to it, and I think it's maybe a little bit out of our purview. I understand 100% why we're doing this. I just think that we need to protect our officers, and I'll be opposed to this bill as long as it has life in this body.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. I haven't heard questions for the bill sponsor for the most part, but we can.
I asked questions.
Oh, right.
I responded.
Representative Vance did ask a question.
And okay. I did respond.
And Representative Hannon responded. Vice Chair Stewart, do you have a comment or question?
Thank you, Chair Carrick. My comment on this is I wish we didn't need this piece of legislation, but because we have had instances in the other states? We've heard an example of one state. I think it's trying to prevent something that may happen in our state. And so I think that's important. I think we met yesterday in state affairs and talked about some other situations. And one of the remedies talked about was to have some tighter restrictions on laws for sharing privacy data to look at this body. And so I see this as in a different arena, but I see this as preparing for if we did have federal police officers come to our state and we're masking when we don't mask police officers in the state. I agree that we should be working, you know, peace officers should be working together at all different levels. I just think that's exemplary how we handle things. But unfortunately, I think we need legislation like this.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. I do appreciate the discussion. I know that we have former law enforcement on this committee, and so I do really respect Chief Case's testimony and Representative St. Clair's perspective in particular here. I also echo what Vice Chair Story said. I wish we really didn't need this legislation. And I do think, for what it's worth, that this legislation is very preventative. This is not a widespread current problem in Alaska, but it's becoming a more widespread issue in other states. And how infrequently do we in Alaska get to do something preventative? It's very typical for us to be the 40th, 42nd, 50th state to do something. And that doesn't mean folks are going to agree with that preventative action. It just, I want to give a lot of kudos to our law enforcement and also recognize that this may be an area where we can prevent the kinds of incidents that we're seeing elsewhere. I would like to, while we have her here, I would like to ask Ms. Heeb to come forward. And put herself on the record and just for the record, tell us if the Alaska Police Standards Council currently has a position on this legislation or if you have any additional comments.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm Sarah Heeb. I'm an administrative investigator with the Alaska Police Standards Council. In response to the question, the Standards Council does not have a position on this at this point in time. And I'm can answer any technical questions on it.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to put that on the record. Do we have additional discussion? Okay. Representative Vance.
Thank you. You just previously asked a question. You said that you think that this legislation would prevent what has been happening across the nation. And I wonder how you think that preventing peace officers from masking for whatever reason they need to in that situation would prevent what I assume you meant is unfortunate deaths of citizens. And then I do have a separate concern, but I think that's kind of the bigger issue here. There's Representative Hannon is wanting to take action in response to what happened and thought that masking was the solution. How is that going to prevent what, by my assumption, and I haven't looked into this heavily, was an accidental death? However it happened, someone died under the hands of these ICE agents that was not intentional, okay? How is a crime that says the peace officers can't wear masks unless it's colder than 32 degrees, how is this going to help those accidental deaths by the hands of law enforcement?
Representative Vance, I can only speak to what I've heard from constituents and I guess my personal opinion. I do think that not masking is a way to help prevent escalation of conflict. And we've definitely seen examples in other states where conflict has escalated extremely quickly. And that's not just on the law enforcement. That is on everybody that's involved. But when law enforcement are masked, there's a lot that's lost in that communication, as there is with anybody who's masked. It would be my personal preference that protesters would also not mask. But I think that's a lot harder to legislate. And protesters are members of the public. They're not in the same position as law enforcement. Just like we do here, law enforcement, particularly when they're in uniform and they're on the job, are acting as public figures, and they're acting as agents of, you know, they're acting as agents of the law. So it's a little, it's a different role than a member of the public. This is just my personal perspective. I guess that's how I feel about it.
Well, I respect that. So the my follow-up to that is, do we have data that shows correlation of escalation to masking and that without? Because there are thousands of other incidents of clear escalation that unfortunate incidents occurred. We just happen to have this most recent one. So it would be interesting. We did have a lot of COVID years where masking was demanded by our government. And do we have incidences of, do we have data that shows that there was more escalation during those times than others? And there are many factors to contribute. But if that's what we're basing this on, I'd like to see the true correlation, because I think there's a lot of assumptions here. But separately, I have a concern about the impact that this will make on recruitment and retention. And I've just looked it up about how bad is it, because we look at what our recruitment and retention of public safety officers are here in Alaska. We know it's been a challenge for many years. This is a nationwide problem. And according to my official Google search here, which, as we know, is highly official in the legislature, it says that retirements from 2019 to 2023 due to increased retirements was up 30% in some periods, and resignations up 47% from 2019 to 2022. That's incredible. We already have a problem with retaining and recruiting public safety officers. And a lot of it, there's a variety of issues, but one thing that's mentioned is public perception. And the police officers, the amount of disrespect and scrutiny that they have taken from the public is simply telling them, we don't want to do it anymore. And I'm concerned that if we tell them, hey, it's going to be against the law for you to wear a mask, whatever situation that you feel in that moment, you need to wear a mask, that's going to be a crime now. I feel like that's sending the wrong message to people who we so desperately rely on for safety in our communities. And I asked the bill sponsor last time if she thought it would have any impact, and the answer was no. When we have law enforcement agencies who are saying, no, we oppose this bill, and saying, no, we need to have this because of what happened thousands of miles away, and we're saying it could possibly happen here. I have great concerns about that. I respect that there are people who feel passionate about this, but I don't think it's going to prevent an unfortunate death that happened simply by saying we're going to make it a crime for peace officers to not wear a mask in a situation that they felt necessary. This is a really, really big deal. And I think it could have much bigger impacts than what we presume. So I don't know if anyone has a response to that, but I thought that's worth mentioning. We have to give a consideration to recruitment and retention of public safety officers, and everything that we do does either has a positive or negative on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Vance. I'll bring the bill sponsor back forward and for continued discussion. Representative Hand.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I wanted to just make sure that the two members who have brought up that I did this in response to deaths were corrected on the record, because the bill was drafted long before the deaths that happened that I think are unfortunate escalations of community violence. Representative St. Clair mentioned, you know, when mobs of protesters are massed, how quickly things escalate. So I think that is evident that when you have people who are not identified, it makes things tenser and tighter. So I'm going to go back to the integrity that our law enforcement have, where they are generally known by their neighbors and doing law enforcement in a way that is supported by their community, that the community wants safety brought, that those are good things. And we want to preserve that as the standard of policing and law enforcement in Alaska. I think Representative Carrick already mentioned it. You know, a decade ago, body-worn cameras was sort of a mixed bag among law enforcement. Some thought it would be the worst thing ever, and others fully embraced it. We do not require body-worn cameras in Alaska, and I've heard our Commissioner of Public Safety say and assert we should have that as a standard for law enforcement in Alaska, that all law enforcement should have body-worn cameras. That's a pretty big ticket sticker item. But I think it has affirmed that it is good for law enforcement to have the verification to the public when they are working with our community members. So I'm going to continue to assert we have a difference of opinion. You view the facts, Representative Vance, in a way that you think it would be discouraging. I think it would affirm. And I have heard from current law enforcement that said it affirms for them that what they're doing is right and they are acting on behalf of the community standard that they want to continue to work under. The bill has more than a cold weather exemption. And I've already worked on an amendment to make sure that, and I guess the vernacular is SWAT operations, could continue with in many of those for tactical gear response would mask because of a specific operation as opposed to general enforcement. But I think some of those operations of ICE that haven't led to deaths are just, you know, anonymous van pulling up on the street and abducting somebody is a fairly terrifying action that most people have been trained to respond to in a fairly volatile way, that this is not what you would expect. And so your first response as an American citizen isn't that this is law enforcement approaching me. This is an abduction, someone with a mask over their face. And we want to make sure that that standard does not become an operational procedure, that when the federal government says, do you have any rules governing procedures around this, we can affirm we have a state law that says this is not allowed for our law enforcement in general law enforcement activities, with exceptions for tactical gear, for smoke and safety, for health, for cold weather, the things that we can predict and say there would be variations on this for specific law enforcement actions.
I have a couple more folks in the queue. We are going to conclude this conversation for today at 4:30, just for members' information. We'll go to Representative Himshut, who hasn't gotten a chance to speak yet, and then back to Representative McCabe.
Thank you. My question is for Ms. Heeb. Chair Carrick.
Ms. Heeb, welcome back.
While she's getting settled, I just want to point out, I think, just a comment also for the committee, but yesterday's hearing to me was also about federal overreach. And I feel like my friend who's a six-year-old grandmother, non-activist in Minneapolis and ended up pepper sprayed trying to get some food to a family that felt like they couldn't leave their homes. It felt like federal overreach for her in Minneapolis. So I think it, you know, everybody has their own perception of it, but I don't like it. Federal overreach is never something I look forward to. So my question for Ms. Heeb, thank you, through the chair. Can you tell me, I should have looked at the standards and I just haven't done that, so it's convenient that you're here, but what is the standard for identification of an officer? So in Alaska, for the officers that the council has jurisdiction over, are they required to wear a name tag? Are they required to identify themselves? What right do I as a citizen have to know who the individual is with whom I'm interacting.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot. The Alaska Police Standards does not have any policy, procedure, regulation on how an officer is required to identify themselves to a person of the public.
Okay, follow-up? Yeah, so through the chair, so then why do officers wear name tags? Is that something you can answer?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, I can, in a generalized way, answer that so they can be identified, so a person knows who they are.
Follow up. How do your standards? How does the council set their standards? Is the council a citizens group or officers or a combination? And how binding are those standards? So in teaching, we have a code of ethics. If you violate the code of ethics, you can lose your certificate. Is your council that? Can you lose your police license?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot. Our standards, we set minimum hiring standards. We set the minimum training standards. And we do have regulations on how a person can fall below those standards and potentially have their certification revoked.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
So also in teaching, thank you, through the chair, also in teaching, we have a certificate and you have to have certain credits and that kind of thing. So the council is deciding what it takes to be an officer. And then does an officer in Alaska hold a license to be a police officer?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, yes, they do. They have a certificate that they get after working for a full year and doing all the things they need to be able to get that.
Follow-up.
One more follow-up.
Okay, really quick. Is there also a code of ethics? And so in my contract as a teacher, when I sign that contract, there is a line in the contract, and it's in every contract in the state that says I will abide by the code of ethics of the teaching profession. Is that uniform in for the officers that your council covers?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, yes. Standard? There is a, in our regulations, there is a code of ethics there that the officer attests to.
Who writes that code? Sorry.
Okay, one more follow-up.
I'm so sorry. Okay, final follow-up. Who writes that code of ethics? Where is it kept?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot. It's actually written in our regulations. The entire thing is written there, so I would have to look. But our regulations are passed and adopted by the Alaska Police Standards Council members.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemshoot. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So regardless of when the bill was written, whether it was before Minneapolis or after in Minneapolis happened because politicians got involved in law enforcement where they had no business being. Aren't we doing the same thing? The COVID masking thing happened because politicians, whether it be a mayor or a governor or a chief medical officer, got involved where they probably shouldn't have been involved. I just think that we're getting involved, or maybe we shouldn't get involved, and we're being very prescriptive. So, and it would be nice to maybe the Chief Case. Well, you said he's not I hate to put Ms. Hebe on the spot because I'm really not. This is more of a departmental thing. It sounds like badging and name tags all fall to the departments, not necessarily to the Police Standards Council. I do know that it seems to me that I called Anchorage or talked to one of my friends that's an APD officer, and they are required, and maybe you could confirm this, Ms. Hebe, if a citizen says, what's your name and badge number, department policy says they are required to say that, if I'm not mistaken. But that's a departmental thing, not a statewide thing.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, yeah, that is a departmental thing on exactly what needs to be responded there.
So thank you. And just a follow up comment. So I just think we make a mistake as politicians and legislators when we get into police department business and how they want to run their departments. And frankly, that's what caused Minneapolis. There's too many politicians. I could talk for another 5 minutes if you want to.
nice agents.
I think we can talk about how politicians really mess a lot of things up. So if you want to talk about that.
I concur with Representative Vance there. I'm hearing a lot of different perspectives on how we're looking at this bill, how we're looking at the issue it's seeking to address, and I'm appreciating the discussion. Are there any final comments from members before we set House Bill 250 aside today? We'll go to Vice Chair Story and then Representative Vance, and then I'm going to ask the bill sponsor if she has any final comments, if she wants to.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I think one thing that happened during COVID, when we talk about retirements of police officers, we had huge retirements from all walks of public safety personnel, our public health nurses, our teachers, you know, all of it having to do with public health. Well, it had to do with the pandemic, having COVID and people realizing, very public-facing positions. We're very grateful for everyone in public service because it is occupation where you are very much interacting with the public, and our public has different agreements about things. And we all know, looking at data from health professionals about saving lives wearing masks, some people disagree with that. The overall perspective was taken that it did save lives. And so I just think we have to always remember the context of everything. And the police officers were certainly a part of what happened to nurses and teachers. And I just don't want us to forget that. And I very much do not. And there's just different perspectives. And I appreciate everyone's perspective because we all have them. And that's why we come together. But I very much don't think politicians really getting involved in the Minneapolis situation made what happened. I think it's unfortunate the federal government felt that they needed to mask in their roles. And I think that intimidated a lot of people and escalated things. But again, that's my perspective, and I appreciate everyone else sharing their perspective. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Well, I just wanted to say that while I disagree with the policy of making it a crime for a public officer to wear a police peace officer to wear a mask, I do appreciate the bill sponsor trying to keep amending the bill to make it work for the different scenarios, because it's there as in the committee substitute, you know, we've seen that there's a lot of different reasons for different types of masks. So I just want to say, while I disagree, I do appreciate that you are trying to find a workable solution for what you think it should be.
Thank you. And I'm going to see if I'm seeing a shake of the head. So with no wrap-up comments for today, we are going to set House Bill 250 aside. And I am setting an amendment deadline for this legislation for Wednesday, March 4th at 5 p.m., which is tomorrow evening. Please get in touch with our office if you have any trouble getting amendments in or back. It sounds like people have already started to work on that.
Well,
Representative Vance.
Can I assume that the changes that this bill sponsor has is going to come as an amendment?
Yes. So, Representative Vance, the changes from the bill sponsor will be offered in the form of amendments.
If you have them to share, that way we don't do anything duplicative. We know the direction that's going. That would be helpful on any changes that we see, if that's... If you feel that that's permissible, I think that would help just to know what we're working with.
Yes, we can definitely accommodate that. It looks like Representative Hannon may also have a comment there.
Through the chair, I believe your staff already has a copy of the amendment that we have had drafted that addresses tactical gear and helmets while riding a motorcycle or a snow machine.
And Thank you for that. We will distribute that amendment before the end of the day today, so that if that informs the preparation of other amendments, be helpful.
Sure.
I have two more comments, so we'll go Representative St. Clair and then Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just ask that tomorrow is a deadline, is kind of short notice, because we're going to inundate legal, because I have at least four amendments. And based off of what I see with the sponsor's amendment, it may change. So can we get a little more latitude, or do we just submit them and then get back with your office and let you know that we have some pending and kind of a gist of what they are?
So just for members' information, please submit your amendments to Ledge Legal. And if you do not have them back by the deadline, please let our office know by the deadline, and we will go from there. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. So one thing I would hope is that we would have a somebody from the Department of Law available for questions during the amendment period, specifically to find out how they would adjudicate an APD officer arresting and prosecuting a federal ICE officer. That would be an interesting to know before we had to vote on this.
That's an excellent request, Representative McCabe. We will be sure to reach out to Department of Law and ask them to be present. Is there any, seeing no additional discussion, is there any wrap-up comment from the bill sponsor today?
Thank you for your time.
So we are setting House Bill 250 aside. Again, please communicate with our office by the bill amendment deadline tomorrow if you struggle to get amendments back from Ledge Legal. And we will now move to our final items for today, House Bill 290 and House Concurrent Resolution 10 from Representative Holland's office, both related to distribution of resolutions. This is our third hearing on both of these measures. At our last hearing, I set an amendment deadline for Monday, March 2nd at 5 p.m., and we received no amendments on either. Is there any additional discussion on House Bill 290 or HCR 10 at this time? And I will ask the bill's sponsor, staff Aiden Nichols, to come up here to the dais. Maybe first, let's go to Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, Chair Carrick. Just as a reminder for folks that are looking at this, House Concurrent Resolution 10 makes a change to the uniform rule to clarify how joint resolutions are distributed. House Bill 290 provides a time period for the governor to return those joint resolutions. This is kind of an accidental issue that I ran into. I wasn't looking for something to change here, and I recognize in looking into this and the work that our staff Aiden has done, is there's a fair amount of variable time in terms of how long the legislature takes with its part of the process, and then it gets handed to the governor's office, which can take another amount of time. And then under the current procedures, it goes to the lieutenant governor's office, which can take some more time. But the cumulative impact of the way we currently are handling joint resolutions is those things that are of significant importance to the legislature, that we take the time and effort to create a joint resolution and go to the effort to pass it, in some cases doesn't allow our voice that we have put that time and effort into to be heard in a timely manner. One example, and this was the one that got me interested in this issue, was the wildfire resolution. We were all across the state concerned about the dire potential of wildfire danger in the spring of 2026. And yet at the end of the day, the resolution that we put together voicing our concern ended up getting to its designated recipients in the middle of October, months after the wildfire season was a distant memory, and we were perhaps looking to the next year on that. I also noted as another example the Energy Council resolution that we passed, a joint resolution recognizing the success and the history of the Energy Council. It met in the middle of September, and it was a month later when the resolution finally got out. So this is an important tool we have to be able to articulate something that we think is of importance, and These changes are not meant to be particularly, you know, looking critically at any part of the process, but to say the current process is not serving us as legislature. It doesn't matter where we are in the legislature. I think this is an improvement for all legislatures in the future to ensure that when they have a critical issue, that there is a pathway for a timely communication of that message to its intended recipients. Now, to that end, Aidan Nickel has followed up on a few questions that came up from the last session. I think he has some information that he just wanted to briefly let you know, responding back to the request that we had to dig in to look to a couple issues. So I'd like to turn it over to staff, if that's okay.
Let's go ahead and do that before we do committee discussion. Mr. Nickel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Aidan Nickel, staff to Representative Holland. So I have two previous questions from committee members to follow up on. The first you will find in documents for today's hearing, and that is a research memo in conversations with Representative Vance. We concluded that the information that we had on the background, the reasoning behind granting the Lieutenant Governor this responsibility, could be strengthened. So we requested that legislative research dig into the question. Unfortunately, they did not find much. So similar to the responses that we've received from legislative legal and from the clerk and secretary, the record shows that the most recent overhaul of uniform rules in 1963 was this somewhat frenzied process, and there's no record of a rationale for Uniform Rule 49. You'll find the extent of this record on the last page of the attachment in the memo. Madam Chair, the second item is a response to a question from Representative Story about how governors in other states handle resolutions. The answer is that based on a survey I did of Western and Midwestern states, most often they don't. Most often the resolutions that are passed by the legislature are not signed at all by the governor. So I surveyed 23 Western and Midwestern states. In 15 of those, it's the case that the governor does not sign any sort of legislative resolution. In the 8 where the governor does sign resolutions, those are Arkansas, Colorado, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, and Utah, and I will provide you all with a full list that will be passed out after this hearing. In every one of those states, there is a timeline by which the governor is required to sign resolutions, and generally it is that the timeline by which the governor is required to sign bills is simply extended over to resolutions. So among these other states, we are an outlier in not imposing any timeline on the governor's signature. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you for those follow-ups. That actually adds quite a lot from the previous discussion. We'll go to Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just noticed this when I pulled up HDR 10. And so the question for the bill sponsor or the staff is on line 6. Well, I'll read it. So all resolutions passed by one or both houses are sent to the governor as a matter of information and for permanent filing with the lieutenant governor. That's the sentence that remains. And then what is taken out is the next line says the clerk or secretary shall send, and we remove the words lieutenant governor, enrolled copies of joint resolutions. So was this an oversight? Because we're removing the sending part to the lieutenant governor, but it's still saying that the resolutions will be permanently filed with the lieutenant governor. So are we creating an administrative issue by removing the words lieutenant governor's? I want to make sure that we're not saying, hey, the lieutenant governor is required to keep permanent filings, but we don't instruct the clerk or the secretary to send it to them. Am I reading this accurately, or is it somehow already covered there?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I believe that is covered in the first sentence. all resolutions passed by one or both houses are sent to the governor and for permanent filing with the lieutenant governor. So my understanding is that through the governor's office, they're still distributed to the lieutenant governor's office, and that falls under record-keeping duty that encompasses matters beyond joint resolutions. Does that answer your question, Representative, through the chair?
I'm always looking for that follow-up.
I'm trying to determine if there's a follow-up, and maybe I've just been, you know, slow on the draw here. Okay. I think you answered my question. It just wanted to make sure that administratively we're still sending to the appropriate ones, because of the way that legal changed the wording. It just looked like there was a hole here. So I appreciate the answer.
Do we have a question, Representative McCabe? Okay. I'm not seeing additional questions or discussion. Again, I wanted to thank the bill sponsor's office for getting back to us on the timeline of recent past resolutions. I think that's a really helpful chart for comparison. I don't see additional questions or discussion at this time. It is my intention to take action on these two items, and we have to do them one at a time. So I would like to start with looking for a motion on House Bill 290. Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move House Bill 290, also known as 34-LS1308. /A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Object.
And there is an objection. Representative St. Clair, would you like to speak to your objection?
Yes, Madam Chair, through the chair. All the references, and I had an epiphany. All the references, the sponsor statement, all the research says joint resolution, but in the bill, nowhere does it say joint resolution.
I'll turn it to the bill sponsor staff, Mr. Nickel.
Through the chair, Representative St. Clair, only joint resolutions are subject to the governor's signature.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative St. Clair.
Permission to read?
I don't think you have to ask for permission to read.
Get to the right one, not to the concurrent resolution. Because an act relating to delivery of resolutions by the governor, and then down what's being changed. If a resolution is transmitted to the governor while the legislature is in session, the governor shall return the resolution within 15 days. Nowhere in this document does it say joint resolution.
I think, though, Representative St. Clair, that's because it's only joint resolutions which are under this transmittal process to begin with. So concurrent, we had that discussion of various kinds of resolutions, but concurrent resolutions or simple resolutions, just House or Senate resolutions, just once they are passed, they are effective. They don't go through the administration. Mr. Nichols, do you have a comment there?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And I would add that it would be our intention if uniform rules were ever amended such that another type of resolution were to receive the governor's signature, we also would want that type of resolution to be involved in this or to be limited by this timeline. Thank you.
I do think, though, this is something that should be potentially looked into prior to these two items moving to the floor, because if there's any reason why we should clarify this in the legislation, I'd be very supportive of an amendment personally that would clarify that if there's a need to. I don't believe that there is a need to, though, but I do appreciate that being brought up. We are under discussion on the motion to move House Bill 290 out of committee. Is there additional discussion? Representative McCabe?
No, I think I'll just leave it for the floor. I mean, I'm going to amend it so that it includes us so that we have a time period to send bills to the governor too. I mean, we're as guilty as Representative Holland said. We, in fact, in some cases, we are more guilty than the executive or the lieutenant governor. So,
and I'll just say for the record to that, Representative McCabe, that's not something I'm necessarily opposed to personally. So I would look forward to seeing that amendment and considering it myself. Representative Vance.
Madam Chairman, I'm going to oppose movement of this right now because if there's still questions about it, this is the only committee of referral before House Rules. And traditionally, we know House Rules does not take up bills unless it's absolutely necessary of a last-minute change. Traditionally, they don't like to have Rules Committee unless absolutely necessary. And so I think it's the responsibility of this committee to make sure that this is sound and well-rounded. I also know that traditionally speaking, the both bodies are very, very hesitant to open uniform rules. In this building, it's as if we were opening the Constitution. And I think that if we were to move something to the floor, we have to make sure that it has been thoroughly vetted and supported. Otherwise, it's opening up a Pandora's box. And so I will be opposing it on those grounds today.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I do just want to note that we did have an amendment deadline that was set more than a week ago. So there has been some ample opportunity here to prepare amendments, to address concerns, to raise them with our office and the bill sponsor's office. And I can only do what I can do when we get very last minute requests. I do think there's always, as a committee chair, the challenge between moving concepts forward that you can support and knowing that this is there's always things you could potentially do to improve legislation. So I would encourage the members of this committee, all of us, to please, if you have concerns that you don't believe you can address through an amendment in the timeline given for amendments, to please reach out as soon as possible. Otherwise, when we set amendment deadlines and plan to take action, we are going to try to do so as much as possible. But I do think, Representative St. Clair, we should try to get clarification on the underlying statute in that section to try to identify whether there's a need for that clarification. I'll go to Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate the discussion. These concerns will help us prepare for the next step in the journey of this legislation. And I would just note that in terms of the functional aspect of these of the resolutions, this has been reviewed, of course, through all stages of legislative legal review. This has been discussed and reviewed by the Lieutenant Governor's office, by the Senate Secretary's office, by the House Clerk's office. We've gone through a lot of steps to ask everyone to look at this, to identify, is this clear and what it will accomplish? So I'm pretty confident that it is clear in its scope and its intent, but to the degree that this conversation highlights that we need to be a little clearer and anticipate this concern. I appreciate it coming up now.
Representative St. Clair.
And I, through the chair, I apologize that it just popped up last minute. I did have an amendment that I did not get back, but that's on me. That's not, they sent me a letter and we talked about it, a memo. But you know what? I'm not going to make an issue. I still want to maintain my objection, but I want to let my colleague to my right here know that it just popped in my head. I just saw it. I've read the material several times and it just came up. And for clarity, I just think that needs to be in there, and that possibly is something we could do on the floor, but I don't like doing stuff on the floor. We need to, but I'll take responsibility for that, but I'm still going to object.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. I'm kind of excited to see the uniform rules open. I'm sure that Representative Mears is as well, because she's got amendments. I probably have a dozen. So I'm excited to get into this one. And I as well kind of lost the bubble on the amendment date. So I apologize for that. And I'm comfortable doing it on the floor. So I'm really looking forward to getting into the uniform rules. There's some really cool stuff.
We've seen a lot of different versions.
Well, consider me shaken in my boots now.
No, I'm not threatening. It's stuff you'll like, too. That's why I'm excited, because we'll vote together.
Yeah. I appreciate that. I also just wanted to add, you know, I know last minute concerns can sometimes come up. I totally understand the desire to react to those last minute concerns. And I also want to point out that this committee is very, very frequently the first committee of referral on bills. And so I don't, as a general rule, have the philosophy that the State Affairs Committee needs to move out the absolute most polished, perfect, completed draft. There's a lot of steps for a House bill in its first committee of referral in the process beyond that. We do take up amendments from members, sometimes a great number of amendments, and it'll be my pleasure to keep doing that. But I just to clarify on some process considerations here, again, just want to reiterate that we have a responsibility to do our due diligence. That responsibility does not extend necessarily to passing the absolute most perfect and completed version of legislation. There's a balance to strike here, given the nature of this body and the process, and we'll continue to try to do our best. And I do appreciate the objection, and I'm guessing it's maintained.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Will the clerk please call the roll on House Bill 290?
Representative St. Clair.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Hemshoot.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
Okay. With a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 290 has moved from the House State Affairs Committee. We will wait until after we adjourn to sign the paperwork. And so at this time, we're going to bring up House Concurrent Resolution 10. Before we do so, Representative McCabe.
You can bring it up. I'll ask during that time.
Okay. So we have House Concurrent Resolution 10 back before us, and at this time I will look for a motion from Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move HCR 10, also known as 34-LS1275/I, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Object.
There is an objection. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So one of the things on this and the previous bill is I would like to see any legal memos that any of us have drafted put into the bill package into basis as well. We could all individually go, but if one of us have memos already drafted, it's easier just to pick them out of basis. I would appreciate that.
Thank you for that. Very brief, please. To concisely summarize the discussion off the record, there have not been any legal memos pertinent to HCR 9 sent to my office from other members. HCR 10, sorry about that, to my office. If members ever have legal memos, I'll just reiterate again on the record, and you would like them to be uploaded to the record, please send them to our office. We'd be happy to do so. Okay, so I don't remember where the objection originally came from. Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Okay. Will the clerk please call the roll on HCR 10?
Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative St. Clair.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Hemshoot.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yeas and 3 nays.
Okay. With a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, HCR 10 has moved from the House State Affairs Committee, and we will sign the paperwork immediately after adjournment. With no additional business to come before our committee, this concludes our business for today. Our next meeting is on Thursday, March 5th, here at 3:15 p.m. Our agenda for the hearing is as follows. Taking up HB 250 on peace officer face masks from Representative Hannon, it seems very likely that that is all we will get to on Thursday's agenda. But if we are able to, we will have continued discussion on House Bill 152, the income tax bill from Representative Galvin, and House Bill 278, the Alaska-Ireland Trade Commission from Representative Costello. And at this time, we are adjourned at 4:57 p.m.